Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some useful nuggets that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, no matter how contrary that might seem. Just like this nightingale, the bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I'm delighted you could join me. There's a bit of a Christmas theme today. Later, we'll hear from Kamran Bedi, the author of a new book called The Anxiety Antidote, and we all know how anxiety can play a big part in Christmas celebrations. But first, we welcome back Professor James Goodwin, who's Director of Science and Research Impact at the Brain Health Network. He's one of the world's foremost experts on brain health, and his groundbreaking book, Supercharged Your Brain, really is the guide to helping you keep your brain healthy for a long and lucid life. Now, I don't know about you, but I see a lot of ads on my phone for games that are supposedly guaranteed to keep your brain healthy into old age and improve your IQ. But do they? As quite a few of us might be playing games, both off and online over Christmas and the New Year, I just had to ask Professor Goodwin if the claims could be true.
Well, we can start with history to begin with. Such games go back to ancient China, a game called Go, and Chaturanga in India. Chess was invented in Persia. If we bring it nearer home, 1974... your listeners ever heard of the Rubik's Cube? Of course.
Oh, yes, I think they have, yeah.
that's one of the most popular games, puzzles or mental challenges ever invented. But by an architect, as it happened, he was trying to find something to teach his students to model in 3D. So these games have been present almost as long as people have been on the planet, as long as civilization has been. I would say from Neolithic times, you've probably got good evidence that there's these games. So there's an intrinsic value and appeal and challenge of all these things. But the $64,000 question is, as you've said, is do they do any good?
Mm.
Well, there's been a lot of evidence because people have sat on both sides of the fence. You've got one party who says that, I think, for $8 billion, people are doing these things because they do make a difference. And on the other side of the fence, you've got people who are saying, well, let's look at the science of it and see what the truth of it is. Let's start with the science of that argument. There's no doubt that brain games increase our level of concentration and our level of arousal, and that they work important parts of the brain. There's no doubt about that. Secondly, if you're good at them and if you enjoy doing them, then they're very positive for our well-being and our self-esteem and our confidence. And those two aspects are really very important to brain health. But there's very little evidence for what we call FAR training, a FAR training value. Now, FAR training value means, if you do these puzzles like Wordle or Sudoku or crosswords, go to the New York Times if you want the gold standard in high-quality puzzles. Okay. So these puzzles enable us to exercise certain parts of the brain only. And they make, as we practice, these games make us better at the games themselves.
Yes.
So you're constantly exercising the pathways in the brain that are required to do these games. And if you measure someone starting a career in these games and then a year later and 2 years later, they become experts at these games. So there's absolutely no doubt about that. That's what we call in-benefit training. So in other words, within the game, they provide that training provides provides a benefit. Now, if you carry out an activity that is similar to those games, there's some evidence that doing them helps you with that other activity. That's what we call near training. But there's almost very little evidence to show that if you do numbers games that will help you with your adding up, your investments, your banking, or calculating your shopping bill as you go around your supermarket, there's very little evidence that that's the case. And what science has found in general is that these games can't make the claim that they're protective against long-term cognitive decline or they protect you against dementia. So in summary, I recommend people play them if they're good at them, they enjoy them, and it challenges the brain, then I'd encourage people to do that. But you mustn't labour under the false assumption that these are going to protect you down the road. Now, there's a massive bun fight in 2014 in the United States. So on the one hand, in one corner, you had Max Planck Institute in Europe, and you had Stanford University in the United States. And they put the boxing gloves on and said, there's no evidence that these games are protective of your cognitive performance, your thinking as you get older. And immediately a response was made to that. This is all public in the magazines and the newspapers. A scientist also from California, who happened to be the chief of staff for the Posit Science Corporation that made games, said that, well, we dispute this. On the side of Max Planck in their corner, Stanford's corner, was Cambridge University, because in 2010 they published a paper in Nature. Now that is going it, because it's a paper in Nature.
Yeah.
To show that it was an interesting experiment, but it showed that there was no far training or protective benefit for carrying out brain training games, if you like. If
I can. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, 3 years later, University of Oslo said the same. So you had Cambridge University, Max Planck, Stanford and Oslo University in one corner, all their gloves on, and these hundreds of other neuroscientists from the Posit Science Corporation in the other, who was right. Well, professor at the University of Illinois said, I'm going to look at every single scientific paper, test, experiment that's looked at the benefits of all this stuff. And we'll see what the outcome is. So they reviewed 130 scientific papers.
Gosh, yeah.
No mean feat.
Yeah.
That was in 2016. And the evidence was, there wasn't any. There wasn't any far training benefit of these games. There was a big study carried out by the University of Exeter, and they published the results of a huge group of people, 19,000 people in their study.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, and they found out that all the people who did these games were better at attention, paying attention, concentrating, that their memory was better and their reasoning power was better. So immediately you would say, well, that's 2019, and that's fairly recent, so what do we make of that? Well, it was an association. So the way you explain that is, didn't show cause and effect, didn't show that one caused the other. And it was probably the lifestyle, what they ate for breakfast, how they led their lives, what they did with themselves, or that they were very intelligent and very well educated in the first place. And that explains why these people who love to do these games are also good at all the mental skills.
Oh, that is fascinating, isn't it? So it comes back to what you always say about brain health, is it's just a whole host of different factors that come together. You know, just doing these games doesn't really help you a great deal. It will reinforce almost what's already there.
there's something called cognitive reserve, and cognitive reserve is our capability to resolve the challenges of life. Now, I'll give your listeners an example. My mother was formerly largely uneducated, but was probably the most intelligent woman I ever met. She must have been in the top 5% for brains. She came from a deprived background, homeless till she was 12 and all the rest of it. So she didn't have that advantage of an education. But from as soon as she could read, right, she read everything there was. My mother would read the sauce bottle at breakfast if there was nothing else to read. She had this immense reserve of self-taught knowledge. And it built up her capability to resolve the challenges that life brought along. And as we mentioned earlier in a previous interview, women have a bigger allostatic load. That's the cumulative burden of stress throughout life than men. And my mum sure herself did. So she had a huge cognitive reserve. Cognitive reserve helps you to get through life. And doing puzzles is not that trivial. It's really quite important because it'll improve that cognitive reserve and it will help you. She had dementia. She died of dementia. But for my mother, it was an emotional problem. She never had a problem with her memory or didn't she? Three years of dementia until she died. And she never forgot who I was. And she had this immense cognitive reserve. So,
yes, you know, what you say about your mother reminds me of my own mother. She could quote Shakespeare to you until, you know, the cows came home, but she had very little formal education herself. Yeah, but she would read. You know, that's probably an important factor as well in your cognitive development, is it, reading?
It is. At 2 years old, the brain is 80%, has reached 80% of its organic maturity. And after that, it's a bit slower and you don't really reach the peak of your brain's maturity until you're about 25. Women earlier, I have to say. you ladies amongst the listeners may smile and laugh at that, but actually it's probably true. But between 2 and 25, our intellectual and brain cognitive development is on a fast trajectory. It's going like a rocket, and that will respond to the environment. So the salient facts of childhood are stimulating environment of any kind is going to produce a better brain than an environment in which there's no stimulation or challenge for the child concerned. So reading is immensely important. I was very disappointed. I know I shouldn't have been surprised when my son told me he got to King's College London and he had a good formal education. And he told me that the vast majority of people in his class, and this is at a really good university and
department,
had never read a book from cover to cover.
Really? Well, I'm shocked at that as well. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing.
He would say to them, "How did you manage to get through your A-levels then?" They said, "Apps, notes, summaries."
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so instead of reading Henry IV, Part 1, right?
Yeah.
They'd read the app and then produce a good exam answer. And Henry said they were the ones who became unstuck because you couldn't get away without reading the whole text in a university like King's College London. So that prepared him well. And my granddaughter, my son's daughter, her first love at 18 months old is books. She'll pick up a book before anything else. That's because she's been introduced to books. Her cognitive development throughout her life until she gets to the last days will benefit from that exposure to a rich educational environment. So you're absolutely right, JJ. Reading, books and words are really, really important.
And starting that from a young age, so from that developmental stage as well.
Yes. They say that your IQ at 11 will explain much of your cognitive skills in your later life. In fact, one of the biggest and best longitudinal studies in Britain is called The Disconnected Mind. I may have mentioned this before to you on your show because I know you're Scottish, JJ. The Scots, genius nation that they are.
We are.
Genius nation that you are. We're the only country in the world to measure the IQ of its whole population of 11-year-olds on one day.
Yes, and I remember when I was at school, we did our IQ test when I was, well, I must have been just 11, and it was an experiment in Fife, which is where I'm from. They sent all the very bright kids who had a high IQ up to high school, as it was then, a year early. And Gordon Brown was one of those as well. I fell into that category, and
Very
not.
intelligent man.
Yeah, and we were sent up a year early because they felt that we could deal with it, that we could benefit from it, and it was extraordinary. But I don't know of anywhere else that did that.
This was in 1947 when they measured the whole nation together.
Yeah, that was a bit
Same
before my
morning,
time.
with typical, precise, Calvinistic efficiency, every child in Scotland picked up its pencil at 9 o'clock in the morning, I think it was the 4th of June 1947, and did the test. Then, of course, when they're in their 70s and 80s, you've got that benchmark. So I was the chief scientist of Age UK at the time, and we funded this study. It was about approximately £1 million a year, I think it was. It was not 800,000 a year. It's a lot of money to do this study, where we took 1,000 of these people, and knowing what their IQ was 11, then looked at how they were doing now. And one of the great findings was that 50% of how they're doing now depends on their IQ at 11.
Interesting.
But the other 50%, most of that is by your environment and your lifestyle, right? So we have still got a big say in how we do. Something to amuse your listeners, we found that all the people who drank the most at age 74 had got the highest IQ.
And when you say drank the most,
Alcohol. The ones who consume the most alcohol got the best IQ. Now, before we all go out ordering ourselves a double whiskey or treating ourselves to a single malt from our own bottle. The explanation was that age 11, these people did well at school, qualified, went to university, led professional lives, and could afford a really high quality of life, which included lots of beer, wine, and spirits.
Interesting.
The alcohol was a bystander. It was all the other well-positioned decisions that they made because of their advantageous lifestyle that made the difference to their thinking score.
That's fascinating. And again, I say it comes back to what you always say, that there are so many factors involved in brain health, and that we would do well to look at all of them. So you're talking about the study that you did with Age UK. How many years after the age of 11 did you do that study with everybody?
It started in 2008, so they're 71 years of age then. And then we
Right.
looked at them every year, and when the pressure was on from the university, we need more money, we need more money. And I think it's reached 10 years, and we got them at 81. So we've got them right the way through their 70s and into their 80s.
Well, there you go. So fascinating. Time for a short break now, though. We'll be back with more from Professor James Goodwin after this from our sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ Stenhouse, and my guest, Professor James Goodwin, with more on what activities stimulate the brain.
There are activities which we do know protect the brain against decline and are protective against dementia. Psychologists call these cognitive stimulating activities. And the central piece of them is learning. That is the centerpiece of them all. But the learning process has got to be really demanding. It's got to put the pressure on you. Okay? It's got to be the activity's got to be high intensity. So it's got to be quick. It's got to be pressured. You have to put a lot of effort into it and a lot of time. It's got to be sustained over a long period. And you've got to achieve milestones and become successful at it. If it has all those qualities, then it's going to protect your brain. And some of the best ones are dancing, learning a language. Those are two spot-on activities. Now, anything else, it can be learning to juggle. Mm. It can be a physical task. It doesn't have to be, well, we say it's just a physical task. Juggling involves huge processing in the brain. But all these activities which place those demands on you that I've listed will protect your brain against dementia. So listeners, get out there and do them. I had an interview with Tristan Ahumada. He's a podcaster in the United States and a very successful business leader. He's really done it. He's not just one of these people selling snake oil.
Mm.
And I was interviewed by him and he said, okay, James, he said, this is how it's looking. You have a drink. You have a really good healthy meal with somebody. Then you go dancing with them and you speak in a foreign language. Then you take them home and you have sex, and then you have another drink at the end of the evening. And that's the perfect formula.
That's the recipe for a healthy brain, yeah. Wow.
Now, the evidence for dancing and learning a language is profound. This is not whimsical or trivial or superficial. It is really, really the real thing. So Strictly Come Dancing, that's the way to go, in my view. And learning a language, I mean, both of them are what psychologists call complex interventions or combined training. They require you to do a lot simultaneously. Now, you look at dancing, your balance and your posture, coordinated movements, decision-making. The social element of empathizing and moving together with another person. These are all tremendously demanding facets of what you're doing. And if you can learn to dance and dance well, that's really Highland dancing. Come on. Highland dancing for all you Scots out there. And for those who like country music, you know, country dancing, Western line dancing, any of it, all the stuff you see, Zumba.
Yeah.
Zumba. Right?
Yeah.
Just all of it is so demanding on the brain. It is going to keep you young for a long time inside your cranium.
Well, it's interesting. We used to do Scottish country dancing at school, not Highland dancing, which is slightly different. Highland, yeah. Right. But Scottish country dancing, you know, the reels, the Dashing White Sergeant and all that sort of thing, Strip the Willow. And it is quite demanding. It's also good exercise. I sometimes think I should get back to doing it. But then, of course, you know, we would also do it regularly at weddings and, you know, all sorts of occasions. There would always be some Scottish country dancing, even at my nephew's wedding not so long ago, amongst all the other, things that we did in terms of celebrating the wedding. We did have some traditional dancing, and it's fantastic.
Experiments have been done, JJ, which have involved programs of learning to dance and followed up by performance tests and images of the brain. What they found that in dancers compared to non-dancers who do some other activity in the test, right, the dancer's volume of gray matter and white matter improves with dancing. And their performance on tests improves, but not until about 6 months of it.
Right.
So it appears to be a loose rule that you'll need about 6 months of this very demanding new activity, dancing, so that it has that far training that we mentioned earlier.
Mm.
Spill over into your performance.
Very interesting. I think I might have to start looking for a country dancing group somewhere and start doing that again. It's great fun and it is very social. I mean, particularly that kind of dancing is very social.
Well, the three pillars of brain health, one is how well we think. The other is how well we connect. The other is how well we feel, think, feel, and connect. Those are your three.
Mm.
Well, dancing has got the connect bit in it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, in my book, I'll mention the title, Supercharge Your
Absolutely,
Brain.
Go for it.
I talk about the Atomic Dance Studio in Berkeley, in California, where they surveyed a large number of dancers, and they all said, it helps us with everything. We feel better. Our emotional regulation has improved. Our day-to-day feel good is much higher now we're dancing. I'm more confident to make decisions. And my social ability, my confidence to approach a woman or a man, it doesn't matter, but has improved because of dancing. They did a survey on that. And so from within the group of dancers, you got this roaring accolade. Yeah, it's an okay activity. This is jolly good for us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And just remind us, the title of your book again is?
Supercharge Your Brain.
Yeah.
And it's published by Penguin, and it's available on Amazon. So you can get it from there. You know, I'm not here to make money out of a book. You don't write books for that, unless you're J.K. Rowling, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
I make, for your listeners, 99 pence a book. So that's the cut. And book publishing is a very expensive business for the publishers as well. Yeah, they do make lots of money out of it, but it was an eye-opener writing the book. It took a long time. It took me 18 months to write the book, 11 chapters.
Yeah. But it is a very comprehensive, very good book, and I do recommend it to anybody who wants to find ways of supercharging their brain and keeping their brain healthy throughout life. I've been taking a few tips out of your book already, having read it. James, thank you so much. And, you know, we're coming up to Christmas when lots of people will be doing puzzles and games. And so basically, you know, it's just a pleasurable activity, really. We have to think about all the other things that are going on.
It is, and there are benefits from it, but it, in themselves, unless they meet those rules I mentioned earlier about having learning within it and high intensity, concentrated effort, sustained, unless they have those, they're not going to protect you against dementia and cognitive decline. They make you good at what you're doing. But there are these cognitive stimulating activities, which people, it's all in my book. The mantra of this and my other interviews is, it's not any single thing. It's the single things you do every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and on that note, James, thank you so much for coming on to the show again and giving us the benefit of your extensive wisdom in this area. And, yeah, thank you so, so much. I'm hoping that you'll come back again and talk about other aspects of our brains and our brain health. So there you are. I bet you never thought looking after the health of your brain could be so much fun. And as we're in the festive season, there's a lot to enjoy. But for some people, this is also a time of high anxiety. Now, if that's you, then my next guest can help you out. Cameron Beddy is a transformational life coach who's passionate about providing people with the skills they need to cope with conditions such as anxiety, but also PTSD, worry, stress, insomnia. He has a whole host of famous and celebrity clients, but he's also an author, and his latest book is called The Anxiety Antidote. Did you know that an estimated 274 million people worldwide suffer from anxiety? That's 4% of the global population. Cameron joined me the other day to talk about his book and how we can deal with anxiety. Cameron, that is an awful lot of people suffering from anxiety in the world. I mean, what is all that about? Where is all this anxiety stemming from?
Well, I think what's happening is, and this kind of comes back to the work that I do and the meaning that's given to anxiety, I think the word anxiety, respectfully, has started to become a very much an umbrella term.
Mm.
And so it's very natural for us as humans on a daily, on a weekly basis with what's going on in our lives and also the unexpected that happens, whether that's in the media or whether it's personally in our lives or, you know, even in our home or the street, to go through different feelings and emotions. And it's very normal to have different feelings and emotions. And what's not normal is to be in a perfect, happy state all the time. I don't think anyone lives like that. And so I think where people are going through experiences, the feelings that they're most likely experiencing, which then get presented as anxiety, the feelings can be things like panic for something that's happening, fear, again, for something that's happening, or future-based, worry. It could be even be nervousness, whether that's something at school, whether it's an exam, whether it's something at work. So things like fear, panic, worry, nervousness, or even just feeling on edge about something. These are the feelings that people experience. They're very natural feelings, and they can come and go, like our experiences can come and go. But what people tend to get used to saying now is, I'm anxious. And we're hearing it more and more. I have anxiety. I'm an anxious person. And it is good to be open and to talk about things. But what I'm directing people to think about, because it's through thinking about it that can help lead to resolution, is to think, what are the underlying feelings?
Yeah.
And, you know, is that panic? Is it worry? Is it fear? And then if you can identify the feeling, what is the cause of that feeling?
Right. Because
a lot of people will generalize that their whole life is anxious, or their whole time at work is anxious, or, and it's not. There'll be a cause to it that will be specific, and that's your window of opportunity to then work with that to transform it.
Right. Okay. And in fact, the title of your book, if I'm right, I'm going to read it here, is, let me just see, The Anxiety Antidote.
Yes.
But how awareness and action can lead to self-control and inner peace. You've got lots of practices and things that you can do to minimize anxiety. But just before we go into some of these, I mean, do you think that people are more anxious now than they used to be? You know, I know you said that it's a common thing now to say, oh, I suffer from anxiety, as if it's, well, it is for some people a big thing. But do you think that in the past we just assumed that a bit of anxiety was a normal thing, and now we don't consider it normal? Is that what you're saying?
I think two things on that. One of the things, I think before, people didn't really know what it was, what they were feeling, what they were experiencing. And I had that in my early 20s. I had a lot of anxiety, but I didn't know it was anxiety. You know, and nowadays we have so much information. We can Google it. We can look at this. We can read up on that. So we can kind of get an idea of what it is. But for a lot of people at a certain time, they didn't have that access. So, you know, the feelings that they felt, the physical sensations they felt, the things that were going through their mind, it was a confusing time. And I guess in that confusion, like a young 20-year-old, it was very easy to ignore it. It was very easy to try and hide away from it, because there wasn't so much on offer on how to deal with it. I think where we are today, kind of coming back to a question, where we are today is we have information like the book and, you know, various things that help people to understand it and how to deal with it. And maybe that has... is what has increased the openness to talk about anxiety, where we're hearing it on a daily, a weekly basis, because maybe now we can connect the dots and think, well, this is what it is. But one of the big things is not only connecting and identifying it, is you've got to work with it.
Yes, yes, I see that. And do you think that it's possible to completely get rid of anxiety in our lives? I mean, a bit of anxiety is probably normal, isn't it? Before you, you know, maybe you're going in to have an exam or something like that. And you're going to feel a little bit of anxiety, aren't you? But it's when it sticks with you, isn't it?
It's when it sticks with you. It can, unfortunately, for some people, grow in its strength and persistence. And I think that's where you have to look at it from a subjective individual perspective. How is my anxiety influencing my life? Because, you know, like you say, some people, they'll have some anxious feelings, the experience will pass and the feelings will have gone. But for some people, if it's still there and it does happen, and if it continues to build and things start to change, like the amount of time you're going out, the amount of time that you're seeing people, whether you're not going into work because of the anxiety, that's really a call for action, that you need to work on it. Because if it's starting to affect various areas of your life, which unfortunately it does for people, that's when it's actually going, it's growing in strength. So it needs to be dealt with. It needs to be resolved.
Yeah. And of course, now we're coming up to Christmas here in the West, which is a massive thing for a lot of people. And it's a time when anxiety levels can really hit the roof, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, hopefully you can tell us a few things that people can do to just allay this anxiety a little bit as we head towards Christmas.
Absolutely. And it can really influence the way that you experience Christmas. You know, if you celebrate it, or if there's people around you that celebrate it and you're involved in that, it doesn't matter how enthusiastic you are about it. Like if it's a part of your month, let's say, it can increase feelings of anxiety. And I think one of the biggest things that a lot of people don't realize that I see is that overwhelm, having too many things to do, having too many things to manage, to sort, to organize, overwhelm can feel very physical. It can feel tiring. It can lead you to feelings of panic or even burnout. And a lot of people over this Christmas period will experience overwhelm, whether that's shopping, whether it's cooking, whether it's preparing, whether it's trying to make everyone in the household happy. Overwhelm can be a real physical response where you then don't end up enjoying everything. So you end up feeling anxious. And the anxiety comes from the buildup, because most of the time, generalizing, a lot of people will have experienced overwhelm over the Christmas period, whether that's with work and finishing that up, whether that's in the preparation for Christmas. So they may be feeling anxious for Christmas, but maybe it's about having less on your plate and, you know, managing the smaller things, not trying to do everything, possibly delegating a bit more or taking a different approach, because that could reduce the overwhelm and therefore reduce the anxiety.
Yeah, so it's a build-up, really, isn't it, around this time of year? Exactly. And if you suffer from anxiety already, so you're already, that stress response is already heightened, it gets even more so. So, yeah, I mean, dealing with things, just chunking things down in size, you know, making things a little bit more bite-sized that you're dealing with, and thinking about that rather than the overall big thing, you know, having the entire family over to yours for Christmas lunch. Oh, no. That's the thing that really gets people, isn't it?
It is. It's overwhelm. And exactly like you say, the more specific you make it, the more you approach things, one thing or a second thing, two things at a time, max. Yeah. Trying to do five things, you're going to feel anxious because you're trying to manage too much.
That's a very good tip there. Time for another short break now, though. We'll be back with more from Cameron Beddy right after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
You're listening to Alchemy 101, and we're back with more from Cameron Beddy, author of The Anxiety Antidote. Now, we've already heard some great tips from Cameron, but I was curious as to whether we really can rid ourselves of anxiety completely, and if so, is that something we can do on our own, or would we be better off seeking professional help?
It can be something that you can try by yourself, and that's what the book does. It gives the reader options to explore and try different methods, and one of the most effective methods that can help people is breathing exercises, which has such a variety of positive benefits. And it doesn't even have to be a long time. A short time to breathe can really help. With anxiety, the nervous system can become overly active and you switch into fight or flight, or for some people, they go into freeze. And so if your nervous system is ramped up and you have that feeling of being on edge, you're not going to enjoy this time of year. You're going to be a bit frantic or a bit grumpy. So just taking time to breathe can help calm the nervous system. And that can help almost defrost the physical response that people can be stuck in and allow them to feel calmer and in effect reduce their overall feeling of anxiety.
Yeah, and you're also more likely to enjoy your Christmas dinner as well, aren't you? Because you're going to be more relaxed. You're not going to get the indigestion that some people experience.
There's only ever benefits from sitting and breathing.
Yeah.
But there's only ever benefits to gain from doing some breathing exercises, whether that's 10 slow breaths or whether that's timed breathing, right? You know, just or even standing outside, getting that fresh air, because changing the environment sometimes can really help, you know. Getting that air in will help with the nervous system, and that can really help with anxiety.
Yeah, and we're probably going over old ground here, but exercise as well, right?
Yes. Exercise, movement, getting out.
Yeah, getting out. People who listen to this show regularly know that I go swimming outdoors all the time, as men, you know, almost daily. And that is a great antidote to any stress or anxiety that anybody might find. Just being in nature.
Absolutely. For me, it's being in nature, walking in the park or going into the woods. It's that fresh feeling around the trees. And it's also very calming mentally, physically. You know, there's so much benefit. And I think talking about things like these, it's trying to get this in over the Christmas period. Because for a lot of people, the anxiety could be that they're going into a closed space with lots of people and they're used to some private space. So it's just taking a moment. I, for myself, on Christmas Day, go for my own individual Christmas Day walk.
Well done.
Even if it's 15 minutes, half an hour, it's that time for myself just to walk, just to breathe, just to step out of it and then come back into it.
Absolutely. Yeah. What a great tip, actually. Just go out for a walk on your own.
Yeah.
And if you breathe. So what I was thinking is you were talking about getting out into nature and that fresh, you know, smell out in nature, in the trees. When you breathe that in deeply, I mean, I find that really relaxing. Don't you?
I find it really energizing.
Yeah.
Relax, energize. And to me, especially being in London in the city, to go into the woods like Highgate Woods or something like that, it's so fresh, the air, compared to, you know, just walking. It's so different, the benefit of being in nature and how it can make you feel.
Yeah, Hampstead Heath is a good one for that as well. Yeah, absolutely. Lovely. Both quite close to each other, in London. But anywhere where you have a park, which has you know, a few trees and just any kind of, you know, natural environment, get out of the concrete and into something a little bit more vibrant. Yeah, fantastic. And so those are a couple of the simple things that people can do. Now, I know as well that you're very much interested in helping men with anxiety and mental health problems. Now, tell us a little bit more about that. Is anxiety something that you would say affects men more, but they don't talk about it? I know that there's been a focus on men's mental health recently. Yes. So, you know, tell us more about that.
Well, it's always context dependent on what's going on in the person's life. So what is happening in that individual's life? So for a lot of men that I work with, whether they're in business, it could be anxiety around their work, their career. It could even be around their parenting and their kids. So it's always context dependent. And that will be influencing them to think in a way which is causing them to feel in a way, because our thoughts will always influence our emotional state. So whatever we're thinking about influences how we feel. Now, the difficulty with anxiety is we could be overthinking and then we're overfeeling. And a lot of the time, men, women, you know, we're thinking through fear. We're thinking through worry. And that's what we're feeding into the body through what our thoughts are producing. A lot of what we're thinking doesn't actually happen. It doesn't actually actualize into reality for the kids, for our job, but we spend so much time in it. And so, you know, with a lot of men, it's teaching them to be mindful and aware of their thoughts how those thoughts are making them feel, and then showing them how to interrupt the pattern through mindfulness, you know, to teach them to have control. It's like having a remote control to their mind to interrupt the pattern of thinking so that it doesn't spiral and so that it doesn't continue to build.
Yeah, it's such a difficult habit for some people to break, though, isn't it? Because it's something that we've done all our lives, it seems. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard. It's almost like an addiction. You're addicted to sort of turning things over in your mind all the time. Yeah. It's very hard to break free of that, isn't it?
It is. And like anything in life, not just our thoughts, it gets easier with practice and repetition. Yeah. Right. And, you know, especially men that are very physical and they'll exercise, results don't come quickly. It's about dedication and consistency. And that dedication and consistency has to have a certain amount of time. It's like doing a mind workout. It's like working with your thoughts, whether it's practicing interrupting those patterns so it becomes habitual and natural, whether it's breathing exercises so that becomes habitual and more natural, or whether it's being mindful with where your thoughts are and how you're dealing with them. It will take time at first, but the more you persevere, the easier, like anything in life, the easier it will become.
Yeah. So how do you suggest somebody starts with the mindfulness, if I can put it that way? I mean, you know, what are the first steps to take?
Well, you have to think, we are in an age now where there's so many options. We've got apps, we've got books, we've got the option to work with someone, right? We're spoiled for choice, but you've got to try. And you've also got to, I'm really glad you asked this, you've got to kind of experiment, because it's like if you go to a yoga class and you don't like the style or you don't like the instructor or whatever it is, you don't just give up and think, sod that, that's it, it's done. You kind of shop around a bit until you find, you know, it's the same with the masseuse. If you go that or whatever it is, you kind of tend to shop around. And it is the same when it comes down to your mental health. So if one book doesn't work, try another one. If one practitioner doesn't work, seek out someone else. If one app isn't good, try another. Like, you have to keep working to find what works for you, because we're all individual and unique.
Yeah, it's an important point, actually, isn't it? And I know that when I was doing yoga, I was very clear after a couple of trials that I do not like the usual yoga studio and being there in a big class.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't comfortable doing yoga. Then I took it up quite late in life. So, you know, wasn't as flexible as a lot of younger people and that sort of thing. So you do have to choose and decide what works for you. Yeah, absolutely. And not be scared of trying. I mean, there's a reason there are so many books out there, you know, and yours is one of them, which is great. But not everybody will resonate with the same book or app or whatever, or even thing to do. One of my favorite things is just sitting in silence. Well, a lot of people just aren't kind of comfortable doing that, especially to start with.
I love that. That's one of my favorite. For me, sitting in silence and sitting in stillness.
Yes. So it's
like a still environment. And I get that a lot in nature as well, because it can be very still and very calming, but actually to do it at home. And I do like, even in busy places, to try and find those moments of silence. Because if you listen out for them and find you can, but exactly, that works for us, but it might not work for someone else. And that's come through practice and repetition and, you know, learning and developing that and putting the time and effort in. Exactly. Like you're saying, it might work for some people, it might not. But shop around, keep going, because there's a lot out there to do.
Yes, and also understand that, you know, you're not going to get things right necessarily to start off with. It's like you were saying before, you know, practice. Yeah. It's a question of practice. You know, you don't suddenly become an Olympic athlete, let's say, without putting in a lot of work, right?
It's okay to be a beginner.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, adults, that's something that we have to, because we've got to, you know, for a lot of people, we've got to a certain point in our lives where we've passed education and studying, we're in our careers and things, but actually there's still the opportunity to learn, you know, in any field and with dedicated time. But for a lot of people, I think they shy away from it because they see it as they've got a problem or an issue and it's easier to hide from it. Well, actually, if you embrace it and learn about it and learn how to manage it, then things can transform.
Absolutely. And so in your book, The Anxiety Antidote, mm-hmm. there are loads of different practices, little things that you can do to alleviate and hopefully get rid of the anxiety that mm-hmm. we might feel. And that book came out in September. So it's available everywhere, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to, because you coach people and, mm-hmm. you know, you work with people one-on-one, and you do talks and that sort of thing. If anybody wants to contact you, where do they find you?
You can find me at my website, camranbeddy.com, or a lot of information I share. If people, you know, are looking for free content, mainly on Instagram, Coach Cameron Beddy.
Aha, excellent. That's good to know. And so then, you know, just to round off our conversation here, which I think has been really useful for people, especially coming up to Christmas, as I say, if there's one thing that you could think of to suggest for somebody who's suffering from pre-Christmas anxiety, what would that one thing be that they could do?
I think what comes to mind straight away is to try and channel your mind and focus your mind on what you can appreciate in any sense around this period. And whether that's on a daily basis, whether it's leading up to it, and especially when you're in it, what can I appreciate? It's like asking a question, looking around, what can I appreciate here? What can I feel grateful for? Because when you're focusing your mind on thoughts of gratitude and appreciation, you can only feel gratitude and appreciation. You can't feel anxious.
Yeah, and the attitude of gratitude, yeah.
So there'll be things, there'll be moments that you'll probably miss and, you know, not get to experience if your mind is wandering off into what if or ahead into time. If you bring yourself into that moment and just look around or hear and feel, what is it here that I can feel grateful for, that I can appreciate in this moment, and do that a few times, then that could help cancel out those feelings and switch it to joy and appreciation.
Well, I think that's a lovely thing to do anyway, but yes, particularly at this time of year. So, yeah, Cameron, thank you so much for bringing your wisdom to the show today. And the book, again, is The Anxiety Antidote, available everywhere, a great resource. So, yeah, many thanks for your words of wisdom today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Cameron Beddy there. And who knows, both books mentioned on today's show could be a great present for someone this year. Once again, I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with my guests. I would have loved to have chatted longer, but sadly, that's all for today. Remember, you can download Alchemy 101 from the UKHealthRadio.com website, and you can find this show on the UK Health Radio podcast. Just search for Alchemy 101 and UK Health Radio wherever you listen to your favourites. Until the next time, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.